Welcome to Just for the Health of It, where we bring you new perspectives on the science of health for all. We will bring you local, state, national, and global health news. Here at Just for the Health of It, we bring you the best of both social justice and personal health. At Just for the Health of It, we focus on putting the just in Just for the Health of It. Our aim is to equip you to live healthily in a healthy community on a just planet. I am your host, Dan Rutt. I have a BS degree in biology and a master's degree in public health, specializing in nutrition. I have worked as a health educator, nutrition counselor, community health planner, and AIDS program director, not to mention dishwasher and busboy. I am a former president of the Ohio Public Health Association. This gig is one of several of my non-paying vocations, including lifelong social justice activist, political satirist, and poet. I am a longtime resident of the Old West End neighborhood in Toledo. Welcome to Just for the Health of It. Here we are, episode number 275. It's Monday, September 23rd. I am recording this from an undisclosed location that looks eerily like my den. Let's start with an international story that might seem a little weird to those in the United States. This is from the World Health Organization. Jordan becomes first country to receive WHO verification for eliminating leprosy. The WHO congratulates Jordan for becoming the first country in the world to be officially verified as having eliminated leprosy. This significant milestone marks as a new era in global public health efforts. Leprosy has afflicted humanity for millennia, but country by country we are stopping transmission and freeing individuals, families, and communities from its suffering and stigma. Jordan's success sets a worldwide precedent, showcasing what can be achieved with strong political commitment, dedication, collaboration, and strategic planning. Although Jordan has successfully eliminated leprosy, the WHO and the Ministry of Health both stress the importance of maintaining robust surveillance systems to detect and manage future potential cases, including foreign-born cases, without discrimination. Jordan's journey highlights the power of sustained efforts in public health and the potential of global collaboration to overcome even the most challenging public health issues. Leprosy, also known as Hansen's disease, is a chronic infectious disease caused by Mycobacterium leprae. It primarily affects the skin, peripheral nerves, mucosal surfaces of the upper respiratory tract, and eyes. Left untreated, leprosy can cause permanent damage to the skin, nerves, limbs, and eyes. Early diagnosis and treatment can prevent disability. Leprosy is a neglected tropical disease which still occurs in more than 120 countries. More than 200,000 new cases are reported every year. Okay, meanwhile, back in Ohio, this from the Cleveland Plain Dealer. In Ohio, black infants 2.4 times more likely to die compared to white infants. Infant mortality remains a major concern in Ohio, as a recent study shows that the disparity between white and black babies has widened. While other states have made significant strides in reducing infant mortality and addressing disparities in birth outcomes, progress in Ohio has stagnated, states a report by Groundwork Ohio, a nonprofit that focuses on policy that impacts children. In 2022, the most recent year of data in the report, Ohio's overall infant mortality rate was 7.1 per thousand births. Since 2012, the rate fluctuated but remained between 6 and 8 per 1,000 births. When it came to white babies, the most recent data showed the infant mortality rate to be 5.7 in 2022. Since 2012, that rate has been consistently below state and national averages, but it is far from the case for black babies. The study found that the mortality rate for black infants was 13.4 per 1,000 births in 2022, nearly twice the state average, making them 2.4 times more likely to die compared to white infants. And of course, the overall rate is way above the under 5 per 1,000 births. That's the national goal. And next up, a new report on the effect of abortion bans. This is from NBC News. A dramatic rise in pregnant women dying in Texas after abortion ban. The number of women in Texas who died while pregnant during labor or soon after childbirth skyrocketed following the state's 2021 ban on abortion care, far outpacing a slower rise in maternal mortality across the nation, a new investigation of federal public health data finds. From 2019 to 2022, the rate of maternal mortality cases in Texas rose by 56%, compared with just 11% nationwide during the same period, according to an analysis by the Gender Equity Policy Institute. The nonprofit research group scoured public available reports from the CDC and shared the analysis exclusively with NBC News. There's only one explanation for this staggering difference in maternal mortality, said Nancy Cohen, president of the Gender Equity Policy Institute. All the research points to Texas abortion ban as the primary driver of this alarming increase. Texas, I fear, is a harbinger of what's to come in other states, she said. Texas law now prohibits all abortions except to save the life of the mother. Fear is something I'd never seen in practice prior to Senate Bill 8, said Dr. Lee Tatum, an OB-GYN in private practice in Austin, Texas. Tatum, who was not involved in this study, said that requests for sterilization procedures among her patients doubled after the state's abortion ban. That is, women prefer to lose their ability to ever have children over the chance that they might become pregnant following SB 8. Unfortunately, it looks like abortion care is not that far different from other health care in the U.S. This from Medical Express. U.S. health care system ranks last among wealthy nations. Americans have the worst health care among the world's wealthy nations, a new report says. People in the United States die the earliest and live the sickest lives out of the 10 developed countries, even though the United States spends the most on health care, according to the annual report by health care think tank the Commonwealth Fund. For the report, researchers compared nations' health systems based on 70 specific measures across five areas of performance. Other nations measured against the United States included Canada, France, Germany, New Zealand, Sweden, and Switzerland. The report found that people in the United States had the shortest lives and the most avoidable deaths, ranking dead last on five out of the six health outcome measures. Americans face the most barriers to obtaining health care. About 25 million people remain uninsured in this country, and nearly a quarter can't afford care when they need it. The United States ranks lowest in health equity, with many low-income people unable to afford care, and more groups reporting unfair treatment and discrimination when seeking care. Patients and doctors in the United States experience heavy administrative burdens when it comes to payment, billing, and paperwork. The U.S. is failing one of its principal obligations as a nation, to protect the health and welfare of its people, said Dr. Joseph Bettencourt, president of the Commonwealth Fund. The status quo, continually spending the most and getting the least for our health care dollars, is not sustainable, he said. It isn't about lack of resources. It's clearly about how they are being spent. Too many Americans are living shorter, sicker lives because of this failure. The report argues that the United States could improve its health care comparative to other nations by extending coverage to the remaining uninsured and reforming health insurance to limit out-of-pocket expenses, investing in primary care providers so more are available to patients, removing health inequities faced by minority and ethnic groups, rural residents, and women, curbing the uncontrolled consolidation of healthcare systems, which is driving prices higher, address social drivers of health like poverty, homelessness, hunger, gun violence, and substance use. This report shows that by adopting proven strategies and making smart investments, America can enhance its health system to better meet the needs of its people. There is no reason we can't elevate our standing if we choose to do so. And next up, of course, preventive services are an important part of a well healthcare system. This report from Medical Express shows us that that is another problem in the U.S. healthcare system. Which Americans are likely to be incorrectly billed for preventive care? Even though preventive care is supposed to be free by law for millions of Americans thanks to the Affordable Care Act, many don't receive recommended preventive services, especially racial and ethnic minorities and other at-risk patient groups. The Affordable Care Act exempted preventive services from patient cost sharing for large chunks of the population. This means that if you receive preventive screening and have private insurance, including through the ACA marketplace, there should be no copay at time of service, and you shouldn't get a bill later on. Easy enough, right? Wrong. Our team of health economists has shown that patients spend millions of dollars every year on unexpected bills for preventive care. The main reason for this is that no specific regulations were put in place to determine exactly which services should be exempt or for whom and how often. This omission has left many people on the hook to pay for valuable health care they thought would be free. Now, in a recently published research in the journal JAMA Network Open, we found the burden of paying for what should be free preventive care disproportionately falls on some patient groups. For example, low-income patients were 43% more likely than high-income patients to have their claims denied. In addition, Asian, Hispanic, and non-Hispanic black patients were each roughly twice as likely as non-Hispanic white patients to have claims denied. Not only were these patients denied routine benefits, but they also saw large differences in rates of billing errors. For example, patients with a high school diploma or less experienced denials due to this kind of billing error almost twice as often than patients with college degrees. All of these services should have been covered by an insurer. Preventive healthcare includes key screenings for cancer, cardiovascular disease and diabetes, access to contraceptives, and mental health checkups, among other services. Ensuring that insurers provide equal coverage for these services for all patients is important to improve health outcomes and quality of life for everyone while reducing future healthcare costs. Our results paint a picture of the kinds of hurdles patients face when they seek health screenings. Patients from underrepresented groups were not only more likely to be told their care wouldn't be covered, they were also more likely to have their claims processed incorrectly, leading to more frequent denials and ultimately larger medical bills. Unexpected bills can affect both a patient's current health and their future use of healthcare services. These hurdles can exacerbate an already tenuous trust in a fragmented healthcare system, making patients less likely to return for follow-up screenings. Stacked coverage denials for patients who live with multiple marginalized identities or who are less able to advocate for themselves can further entrench racial and socioeconomic inequities. Equitable policy on multiple fronts can help rectify the way preventive care is inconsistently and inequitably provided. These include uniform coverage of preventive care by insurers, standardized billing practices for physicians, and improved means for patients to advocate for themselves. This can help ensure that everyone has appropriate access to life-saving health care. And unfortunately, that's one of the problems with being disfranchised, is that the people that can least afford it are the ones who end up paying the cost. Okay, well, let's turn to a little bit better news. Got a few stories here on substance abuse. This first one from NPR. U.S. sees a sudden and unexpected drop in fatal overdoses. For the first time in decades, public health data shows a sudden and hopeful drop in drug overdose deaths across the U.S. National surveys compiled by the CDC already show an unprecedented decline in drug deaths of roughly 11%. That's a huge reversal from recent years when fatal overdoses regularly increased by double-digit percentages. Some researchers believe the data will show an even larger decline in drug deaths when federal surveys are updated to reflect improvements being seen at the state level, especially in the eastern U.S. In the states that have the most rapid data collection systems, we're seeing declines of 20%, 30%, said Dr. Nabarin Dasgupta, an expert on street drugs at the University of North Carolina. According to Dasgupta's analysis, which has sparked discussion among addiction and drug policy experts, the drop in state-level mortality numbers correspond with similar steep declines in emergency room visits linked to overdoses. Dr. Dasgupta, a researcher at the University of North Carolina, is an expert on the U.S. street drug supply. He believes data shows a sudden drop in drug overdose deaths nationwide that could already be saving roughly 20,000 lives per year. After years of wrenching drug deaths that seemed all but unstoppable, some researchers, frontline addiction workers, members of law enforcement, and people using street drugs voiced caution about the apparent trend. Roughly 100,000 deaths are still occurring per year. Street drug cocktails, including fentanyl, methamphetamine, xylazine, and other synthetic chemicals, are more poisonous than ever. I think we have to be careful when we get optimistic and see a slight drop in overdose deaths, said Dean Salter, who heads a federal drug interdiction program in the Atlanta Carolinas region. The last thing we want to do is spike the ball. But most public health experts and some people living with addiction told NPR they believe catastrophic increases in drug deaths, which began in 2019, have ended, at least for now. Many said a widespread, meaningful shift appears underway. Some of us have learned to deal with the overdoses a lot better, said Kevin Donaldson, who uses fentanyl and xylazine on the street in Burlington, Vermont. According to Donaldson, many people using fentanyl now carry naloxone, a medication that reverses most opioid overdoses. He said his friends also use street drugs and others nearby, ready to offer aid and support when overdoses occur. He believes these changes are a response to the increasingly toxic street drug supply, meaning more people like himself are surviving. Why the sudden and hopeful shift? Most experts say it's a mystery. While many people offered theories about why the drop in deaths is happening at unprecedented speed, most experts agreed that the data doesn't yet provide clear answers. Some pointed to rapid improvements in the availability and affordability of medical treatments for fentanyl addiction, expansion of naloxone, and medication for opioid use disorder. These strategies work, said Dr. Volko, director at the National Institute for Drug Addiction. We've almost tripled the amount of naloxone out in the community. One survey in the Seattle area found 85% of high-risk drug users now carry the overdose reversal medication. Dr. Rahul Gupta, the White House drug czar, said the drop in drug deaths shows a path forward. Gupta called for more funding for addiction treatment and healthcare services, especially in Black and Native American communities, where overdose deaths remain catastrophically high. There's no way we're going to beat this epidemic by not focusing on communities that are often marginalized, underserved, and communities of color, Gupta said. But even some researchers who support wider public health and harm reduction programs said it's unlikely those efforts alone are causing such a sudden decline in drug deaths. We don't have anything that would predict this magnitude of effect this quickly. Addiction experts pointed to a number of possible factors other than public health strategies that could be contributing to the drop in fatal overdoses, including the change in makeup of the street drug supply. Fentanyl may be harder to find and less pure in some areas because of law enforcement efforts targeting Mexican drug cartels. And I stop right here and add a little note. I reported in the last couple months about the fact that one of the major supplier of fentanyl, the biggest Mexican fentanyl cartel, actually just stopped dealing with fentanyl, and that reduced the drug supply a lot. That wasn't directly related to law enforcement and still remains a mystery, but it shows that these other vagaries outside public health or law enforcement efforts may be actually what's driving this change. The chemical xylazine is also being mixed with fentanyl by drug gangs. While toxic in humans, causing lesions and other serious long-term health problems, xylazine may delay the onset of withdrawal symptoms in some users. Das Gupta said it's possible that means people are taking fewer potentially lethal doses of fentanyl per day. Other experts pointed to the end of the COVID pandemic, combined with a high number of people who have already died from drug overdoses, as possible causes of the abrupt change. Dr. Daniel Ciceroni, a physician addiction researcher at the University of California, said a debate is already underway over what triggered the improvement and what happened next. This is where we're all going to differ. Everyone is going to come out and claim that what they did is what caused the decline, he said. But he agreed that for now, the improvements appear real. What makes it fascinating is the speed at which it's happened. Overdose deaths in Ohio are down 31%. Indeed, in many states in the eastern and central U.S. where improvements are largest, the sudden drop in drug deaths stunned some observers who lived through the darkest days of the fentanyl overdose crisis. This year's overdose deaths in Ohio are down 31%, said Dennis Cochin, a harm reduction activist. The deaths are just plummeting. The data has never moved like this. And that's great news for Ohio, but I would say that an 11% drop in a year, even though this could be considered early data, I have reported before when there was a slight decrease last year, they were expecting some further decrease. 11% is not a huge drop, but of course, it's a welcome reversal of a catastrophic trend. Okay, well, on another front on dealing with the addiction crisis, this from Medical Express, more than three quarters of U.S. states have enacted laws to guide use of opioid litigation proceeds. As of December of last year, 40 states have laws regulating the use of opioid litigation proceeds, a 25% increase from the 32 states that enacted laws as of August of 2022, according to new data published from the Center for Public Health Law Research at Temple University School of Law. As the opioid overdose epidemic continues to ravage the United States, approximately 3,000 state and local governments have sued opioid manufacturers and distributors for compensation for opioid-related harms. These lawsuits have resulted in major structured settlements to certain states and local governments, presenting an opportunity to fund a public health approach to abate the epidemic. National experts partnered in 2021 to develop model state legislation that directs state use of opioid litigation proceeds to fund evidence-based substance use disorder prevention, treatment, recovery, or harm reduction programming, infrastructure, evidence-informed pilots, and establish a council to administer and direct the funds, among other activities. Since then, more laws have been put into effect as an attempt to regulate the opioid overdose epidemic. Consistent with previous trends, the state laws included in the updated data frequently involve the creation of opioid settlement councils tasked with recommending or directing the allocation of funds. In some states, additional legislation specifies the composition and membership criteria for these councils. As of December of last year, the data show 26 states and D.C. require the establishment of a council to recommend or direct spending from the funds. This is up from an increase of 22 jurisdictions as of August 2022. In 12 of those jurisdictions, the council has decision-making authority as opposed to being advisory, much stronger. 15 states in D.C. require council representation of individuals with lived experience with substance use recovery, an increase from 13 jurisdictions in 2022. 15 states in D.C. stipulate that evidence-based substance use disorder programming is a core focus of spending, an increase from 11 jurisdictions from 2022. 11 states in D.C. require the fund to supplement existing substance use disorder program funding. This is a really important point because a lot of states in the past, like with tobacco use, or if you even look at like Ohio State Lottery, when they say it's going for education funding, what they basically do is replace existing funding with another source. So these 11 states in D.C. are actually requiring that it's new money for dealing with it, not just replacing a pre-existing stream so that other money can be spent on something else. 15 states in D.C. secure the money within the fund, making sure the money will not revert to the general fund of the state treasury. And Ohio is an unfortunate example of that with the tobacco settlement. They had started off pretty good, much better in the top quarter of states as far as the strength of their settlement funds, actually dealing with the public health problem of tobacco. But over the years, the state house just took that money back and put it in the general fund. These data can be used to assess states' programs in enacting the Opioid Litigation Proceeds Model Act, identify gaps in existing state laws, and demonstrate the utility of policy surveillance methods for assessing adherence and diffusion of model legislation. So, some success on that front. Okay, and one more substance use story, this from MedPage Today. U.S. will let more people take methadone at home. The first big update to U.S. methadone regulations in 20 years is poised to expand access to the life-saving drug starting next month. But experts say the addiction treatment changes could fall flat if state governments and methadone clinics fail to act. For decades, strict rules required most methadone patients to line up at special clinics every morning to sip their daily dose of the liquid medicine while being watched. The rules, built on distrust of people in the grip of opioid addiction, were meant to prevent overdoses and diversion, that is, the illicit selling or sharing of methadone. The COVID-19 pandemic changed the risk calculation. To prevent the spread of the coronavirus at crowded clinics, emergency rules allowed patients to take methadone unsupervised at home. Research showed the looser practice was safe. Overdose deaths and drug diversion didn't increase, and people stayed in treatment longer. With evidence mounting, the U.S. government made the changes permanent early this year. October 2nd is the date when clinics must comply with the new rules, unless they're in a state with more restrictive regulations. Alabama, where about 7,000 people take methadone for opioid use disorder, plans to align with the new flexible rules, said Nicole Walden, a state official overseeing substance use services. This is a step toward the country and everybody saying this is not a bad thing, Walden said. People don't have to show up every day to get a medication that can help save their lives. Methadone, an opioid itself, can be dangerous in large amounts. When taken correctly, it can stop drug cravings without causing a high. Numerous studies have shown it reduces the risk of overdose and the spread of hepatitis C and HIV, but it cannot be prescribed for opioid addiction outside of the nation's 2,100 methadone clinics, which on a given day treat nearly 500,000 U.S. patients with the drug. The new federal rules allow stable patients to take home 28 days worth of methadone. Colorado, New York, and Massachusetts are among states taking steps to update the rules to align with the new flexibility. Some others have not, including West Virginia and Tennessee. Unfortunately, the states with the nation's highest drug overdose death rates. Where you live matters, says University of Arizona researcher Beth Meyerson, who studies methadone policy. Phoenix resident Irene Garnett would welcome more take-home methadone doses. Her clinic now requires her to come in twice a week, even though she's been a patient there for more than 10 years, which is just bonkers, she said. Garnett, who works as a grant manager for a harm reduction agency, lives 25 minutes away from the clinic. She said 28 days of take-home methadone, the maximum allowed under the new federal rule, would give her more freedom to travel and a, quote, more normal quality of life. This is the only medication where you have to disrupt your life by going someplace every day, she said. Under the new rules, which Arizona plans to embrace, clinics will have broad discretion about which people qualify to take for take-home doses. Ideally, such decisions will be made jointly between doctors and patients, but money will play a role too, experts said. Francis McGaffey, who researches substance use treatments for the nonprofit Pew Charitable Trust, said payments to clinics are sometimes tied to in-person dosing, which can discourage take-home treatment. States should look at their payment policy and see what kind of care they're incentivizing, she said. In Arizona, clinics now get $15 per in-person dose from the state's Medicaid program versus about $4 per take-home dose. The state is considering options including making those amounts equal or adopting what's called bundle payment, a model that reflects the overall cost of treatment. New York's Medicaid program uses a bundled payment model, so there's no financial incentive for in-person dosing. Longtime methadone patient David Frank, a 52-year-old New York University sociologist, gets 4 weeks of take-home methadone in water form, in wafer form, from his clinic. I never in a million years could have gone back to school, got my PhD, done research, or taught any of that stuff if I had to go to a clinic every day, Frank said. It's night and day in terms of your ability to live a stable, happy, quality life. In states that adopt the rules, methadone treatment can start faster, people will no longer need to demonstrate a one-year history of opioid addiction, counseling can be optional instead of mandatory, telehealth can be used to assess patients, improving access for rural residents, nurse practitioners and physician assistants, not just doctors, can start people on methadone. It's really up to the states to adopt these changes in order to increase access to care, said Mark Perino, president of the American Association for Treatment of Opioid Dependence. Tennessee officials have drafted new rules that are stricter than the federal government's. The state's proposal would increase random urine drug screening, make counseling mandatory for many patients, and obligate clinics to hire pharmacists if they want to dispense take-home doses. The state's proposed rules are duplicative, contradictory, prescriptive, rigid, and written in a way that seeks to punish versus heal people living with opioid disorder, wrote Zach Talbot, who operates 4 methadone clinics in Tennessee, Georgia, and North Carolina. In states that do adopt the federal rules, the changes will be a heavy lift for some clinics, experts said. Some clinic leaders may disagree with the patient-centered philosophy behind the changes. Some may balk at the legal liability that goes with judgment calls about which people can safely take methadone at home. Not all opioid treatment programs are created equal, said Linda Hurley, CEO of Rhode Island's oldest methadone program. Clinics are used to operating within a highly restricted environment, said Meyerson, the University of Arizona researcher. We have regulated them into a corner for years. The new rules allow the clinics to put the well-being of patients at the center of care. The question is, she said, can they do it? A good question for the methadone industrial complex. You are listening to Just for the Health of It on WAKT 106.1 FM Toledo. We Act Radio. Just for the Health of It is the People's School of Public Health in the University of Life. My personal guarantee to you is if you listen to this show for 1 year, you will know more about public health than 99% of the population. And if that should turn out to not be true, I will gladly give you triple your money back. Okay, well, let's turn to a series of environmental stories. First up, an editorial from the Environmental Health Network. Is plastic the biggest climate threat? As people from around the world are gathering in New York for the UN-sponsored Climate Week, it's past time the world focused on the threats to climate from plastics. For decades, the fossil fuel industry has rightly been the target for climate action. It was major news last year when the UN Climate Change Conference, for the first time in decades, agreed on calling for a transition away from fossil fuels. Wow. But many miss the loophole in that statement. Fossil fuel producing countries only agreed to this language with the caveat that the transition would be away from fossil fuels in energy systems. The agreement says nothing about moving away from fossil fuels for plastics or chemicals. With the rapid rise of electric cars and other electrification technologies, the oil and gas industry is looking to plastics and the chemicals that go into plastics as their primary new markets. Many people don't know that plastics are made from oil and gas mixed with chemicals, mostly petrochemicals that are also produced from fossil fuels. Plastics are the industry's golden goose, and they are gearing up for a massive expansion in production. A recent report noted that Chevron, Shell, and oil-producing nations are responding to predictions about the decline of their industry with large investments in petrochemical and plastic production. They believe their future is plastics. But scientists are warning that more plastics means more threats to the climate. A study from the U.S. government's Lawrence Berkeley National Laboratory earlier this year found that greenhouse gas emissions from plastics could triple by mid-century, accounting for 20% of the remaining carbon budget before planetary disruptions become unbearable. Other researchers have found that pollution from plastics and chemicals has already exceeded the planetary boundaries for sustaining life on Earth. Some say more recycling will fix the plastic problem, but plastic recycling has remained at less than 10% globally for decades. And because plastics are made with toxic chemicals, recycling simply spreads these chemicals to new products. Despite the climate agreement's call to transition away from fossil fuels, the industry is aiming to triple plastic productions by 2050. This means increasing fossil fuels extraction and petrochemical production, with the attendant and potentially disastrous climate, health, and environmental consequences. Increasing production of plastics derived from fossil fuels will not only threaten the climate, but also our health. A recent study found that more than 4,200 chemicals used in plastics are known to be highly hazardous to health or the environment, and thousands more plastic chemicals have never been tested for safety. Chemicals common in plastics are linked to cancer, impacts on brain development and behavior, infertility, low sperm count, reduced testosterone and estrogen levels, impacts on neurodevelopment and IQ performance, immune system damage, and endocrine disruption, among other health concerns. While the UN Climate Week is in the spotlight, the world is also in the process of negotiating another significant climate pact, the UN Plastics Treaty, a global agreement aimed at addressing the plastics crisis. Given the stakes, the treaty should be considered a climate and health agreement that addresses the climate and toxic threats throughout the life cycle of plastics. We must understand plastics as a mixture of carbon, that is, fossil fuels, and chemicals, and address the climate and health consequences when fossil fuels are extracted to make plastics, when petrochemicals for plastics are produced, when plastic production and disposal threatens nearby communities, and when plastic products pose a risk to consumers. In short, a plastics treaty for the climate and health must address overproduction of plastics and head off the petrochemical and plastic industry's planned expansion. To miss this opportunity to rein in these polluting, toxic industries could have disastrous consequences for generations to come. And next up, drilling down to plastics and food, this from Conscien Health, 14,000 chemicals in food packaging, 3,601 enter our bodies. A new study gives pause for concern about the chemicals entering our body from food packaging. Some of them are endocrine-disrupting chemicals that can alter the way our body stores fat. Researchers inventoried a total of 14,000 chemicals in contact with food from packaging and found evidence of 3,601 of them being measurably present in human bodies. They identified 100 of these chemicals that have hazard properties of high concern for human health. Gee, only 100? Thomas Zoller, an emeritus professor of biology at the University of Massachusetts, he was not involved in the study, but he told the Washington Post, it shows the subject needs more attention. Quote, "We don't think about how the mostly plastic packaging adds chemicals to our food, but it's an important source of human exposure. This is an early indication that harmful chemicals, largely unregulated, are making it into the human population." The authors conclude their paper with a call to action. This evidence base supports policy and decision making and highlights the urgent need to ban the most hazardous chemicals shown to migrate from food to packaging, food packaging, and other types of food contact articles into food to protect human health. The FDA is convening a public hearing as a step towards developing a better monitoring of these chemicals. Zoller and former National Institute for Environmental Health Director Linda Birnbaum writes that this reassessment is past due. While it largely flies under the public radar, the FDA's neglect to update its testing to reflect modern science and modern food chemical hazards is a decades-long crisis that impacts all of our health. Indeed, the hazard of endocrine-disrupting chemicals seeping into the food supply deserves our full attention. Okay, next up from Science Daily, metal exposure can increase cardiovascular disease risk. Metal exposure from environmental pollution is associated with increased calcium buildup in the coronary arteries at a level comparable to traditional risk factors like smoking and diabetes, according to a study published today in the Journal of the American College of Cardiology. The findings support that metals in the body are associated with the progression of plaque buildup in the arteries and potentially provide a new strategy for managing and preventing atherosclerosis. Our findings highlight the importance of considering metal exposures as a significant risk factor for atherosclerosis and cardiovascular disease, the lead author of the study said. This could lead to new prevention and treatment strategies that target metal exposure. This groundbreaking study underscores the critical associations of metal exposure from environmental pollution to heart health. It challenges us to broaden our approach to cardiovascular disease prevention beyond traditional risk factors and to advocate for stronger environmental regulations. and it underscores the need for continued research in this critical area. Researchers used data from the multi-ethnic study of atherosclerosis prospective cohort, tracking over 6,000 men and women aged 45 to 84 from diverse racial backgrounds free from clinical heart disease, to measure urinary metal levels at the beginning of the study in 2000 and 2002. They examined non-essential metals, that is cadmium, tungsten, and uranium, and essential metals, cobalt, copper, and zinc, both common in the U.S. populations and associated with cardiovascular disease. Widespread cadmium, tungsten, uranium, cobalt, copper, and zinc pollution occurs from agricultural and industrial uses, such as fertilizers, batteries, oil production, welding, mining, and nuclear energy production. Tobacco smoke is the main source of cadmium exposure. The study's analysis also considered traditional cardiovascular disease risk factors such as smoking, diabetes, and cholesterol levels. The associations between metals and cardiovascular disease progression were comparable in magnitude to those for traditional risk factors. Pollution is the greatest environmental risk to cardiovascular health. Given the widespread occurrence of these metals due to industrial and agricultural activities, this study calls for heightened awareness and regulatory measures to limit exposure and protect cardiovascular health. And this is just another good example of basically any type of production in modern society, things that we consume, industrial products, consumer products, food, produces a lot of this metal pollution, which of course can affect our health, and in this case, heart health. We need to address reducing consumption overall as a primary way of dealing with such burdens of toxic metals. Okay, well, next up from the Environmental Health Network is a story that gets at how the Inflation Reduction Act's supposed green energy promise is putting black communities at risk with no environmental benefit. So this Inflation Reduction Act was the largest climate change policy ever enacted in the world, let alone the U.S., but it's a mixed bag to this story. A proposed tax credit for biomass energy plants could accelerate pollution in black communities in the rural South, where forests are already being depleted for European energy demands. And they in Europe, they use a lot of these wood pellets for fuel. Biomass plants, which burn wood pellets for energy, emit carcinogens and other pollutants, disproportionately affect black and low-income communities. The proposed tax cuts could subsidize biomass facilities, despite evidence that these plants are more harmful to the environment than coal. Over 1 million acres of forests in this rural South are being cleared for biomass production, worsening health and environmental outcomes for local residents. Why this matters? Communities like Adel, Georgia, are left with the pollution, loss of green space, and the destruction of the various forests we depend on to capture carbon. It's an ironic twist. Clean energy for Europe, while black communities in the South bear the brunt of the damage. Just shooting ourselves in the foot. But hey, another way to make a buck and get a tax break. Proposed tax break. It still hasn't been finalized. A lot of pushback. Okay, well, the next story, also from the Environmental Health Network, gets at the dangers of actually pushing back as a bureaucrat in the environmental health system. EPA workers faced retaliation for exposing chemical safety risks. Three U.S. EPA scientists who resisted management pressure to downplay the dangers of new chemicals were retaliated against, according to an Inspector General's report. The EPA's Inspector General found three scientists were unfairly punished after refusing to hide chemical harms, including links to cancer and miscarriages. Supervisors attacked the scientists and reassigned them within the EPA's new chemical division, calling them, quote, stupid and pot stirrers. The agency is now reviewing whether further action is needed, with whistleblower protection and scientific integrity training underway. The key quote in this article, these whistleblowers have been beaten down, ostracized, and punished when all they were trying to do is protect us. Why this matters? The incident highlights the risk of political or industry pressure undermining scientific integrity at the EPA, which could lead to less effective regulation of potentially harmful chemicals. Protecting whistleblowers is crucial to ensuring transparency and safeguarding public health. Okay, well, next up, I want to end the regular reporting with a little bit better news here. This is from the Environmental Health Network. London's low emission zone got kids out of cars and onto their feet. A year after London's clean air zone was enforced, 40% of children began walking or biking to school instead of being driven, according to new research. A study found that 40% of kids in London's ultra-low emission zone switched from car rides to walking or biking within a year of the policy's start. In contrast, only 20% of children in the control group, Luton City, made the same switch, with an equal number starting to drive. Researchers say this shift could combat childhood obesity, improve both mental and physical health. Why this matters? Research shows that penalizing driving, rather than just building bike lanes or walking paths, is often more effective at getting people out of their cars. And whether it's through incentives or penalties, the takeaway is clear. What's good for the planet is often what's best for the kids, too. So if you wanted to do business, like be a delivery vehicle or such, in that particular area in London, if you didn't meet certain emission standards, you had to pay a fee. So it reduced emissions and got people moving by bikes and walking. Okay, well, that brings us to our last feature of the show, bonus articles, a carefully curated combination of headlines you can use and long reads for increased enrichment, available online, just like all the stories I've reported on in this episode. You can read these by going to toppond.com/blog/WAKT. I'll give that link again at the end of the list. 42 bonus stories this week, so let's get rolling. First up, wastewater monitoring can detect foodborne illness. Add another thing to the list. Wastewater monitoring is a great thing that can be done with, it's non-invasive and it works, gives earlier signs than what would happen if you were testing individuals. Bonus article 2, Mpox is not under control in Africa, warns Africa CDC. Probably not a surprise those are following it, but a good overview of where we're at with the Mpox international emergency. Bonus article 3, amid new Mpox outbreak, study suggests waning protection of vaccines. So this isn't particularly good news. This means that after a year or so, you see quite a bit of waning of the protection, unfortunately, that means if we're going to deal with a long-term Mpox outbreak and potentially being endemic, like the other version of Mpox is already in the U.S., has been in the U.S., is probably going to stay in the U.S. If the newer version, which is more serious and more transmissible, that we'd probably likely expect to follow a similar course. It's going to be tricky because it's not a one and done that you just get the Mpox vaccine or two doses and then you don't have to worry about it ever again. If you have waning protection, you need to get additional doses over time, making it more difficult or getting better vaccines. Bonus article 4, polio's last stands, the global fight for eradication. This is a good historical overview of the fight against polio, which used to be a massive killer and disabler in the U.S. and around the world. But of course, the last stand is really in Afghanistan and Pakistan. But of course, it's cropped up again in Gaza recently. So we've gone backwards a little bit. Bonus article 5. Child flu deaths last season matched U.S. record high. So if it's you thinking it's just the flu, flu still kills kids. And we had a record high last season. Bonus article 6. The next pandemic virus could be built using AI. So AI can have a lot of good purposes, but can be used nefariously, and it's been used to build viruses before, so look out. Bonus article 7. Critics call Fed's response to cyber attacks on healthcare feeble and fractured. So this is the most common cyber attacks are the healthcare sector is the sector that gets the most cyber attacks of any sector in our economy, and it needs to be bolstered. Bonus article 8, FTC sues top pharmacy benefit managers over insulin prices. So they're manipulating the prices so they can make the most profit, and unfortunately that raises prices for everybody else. Bonus article 9, older migraine drugs more effective than newer ones. So pharmaceutical companies, that innovation for the sake of innovation doesn't necessarily move us forward. In some cases, it moves us backwards. Bonus article 10, how I fought Big Pharma on insulin prices and won. Key to that story is by avoiding the trap of taking money from our opponents. Great strategy to co-opt your opponents. Bonus article 11, how the food industry fights soda taxes. This is a great report for a long read if you want to see how commercial determinants of public health work with various industries. They are very good at avoiding regulation and such. Bonus Article 12. Exposure to microplastics contribute to liver disease and other metabolic disorders. Just another study of showing how microplastics are dangerous. Bonus Article 13. Microplastic pollution is expected to double by 2040, even if production stops. This is because plastic breaks down into microplastic. Microplastics break down into nanoplastics. So even without another ounce of plastic produced, which is not going to be the case, they're talking about tripling production by 2050, even then, the plastic that's already out in the environment will double the amount of microplastic in the next 15 years. Bonus Article 14. North Carolina's poultry industry surges, but at what cost to the health and environment? So raising livestock is a very dangerous for the health and the environment. And you might want to actually throw in there the whole bird flu thing. People, you know, if we didn't have all these millions and millions and millions of birds all concentrated in one little place, we wouldn't be dealing with the bird flu problem. Bonus Article 15, U.S. methane emissions continue to rise despite global reduction pledges. So we say one thing and we're doing another. Bonus Article 16, judge halts methane regulation in five states over states' rights dispute. So just one more area where trying to get strict regulations to control methane is being thwarted. Bonus Article 17, car travel now exceeds pre-pandemic levels in most U.S. cities. So this is another underlying dynamic, is that even though we are moving to somewhat more electric cars and hybrids and such, we're actually doing more car travel. So it puts pressure on how much energy we use and how many cars we need to build. Bonus Article 18, steel and aluminum industries bring environmental and health concerns despite growing demand. So part of the increase for steel and aluminum is actually the growth in the quote green economy. This gets back to the metal story that I did about cardiovascular diseases. Pretty much any kind of consuming we do has these side effects upstream about resource pollution. Bonus Article 19. Report outlines a path to prosperity for planet and people if Earth's critical resources are better shared. So this is just really a matter of equity, and that we have a small amount of people using a huge amount of resources and most people using a very small proportion of it. If those were shared equally, you could actually get better benefit for less resources consumed. Bonus Article 20. Nation's first carbon capture project faces early corrosion issues, raising long-term safety concerns. So this is relatively new. This is only like a 5, 6, 7-year-old project, and they're already facing corrosion issues, which is releasing toxins, and it could be potentially pollute the water supply, etc. So the only problem with carbon capture is you need to basically hold it forever. So it's not just 10 years, 50 years, 20 years, three generations. It's basically forever. Bonus Article 21. Ranchers secretly use chemical defoliants to clear Brazilian forests for beef production. Again, here's more livestock production in one of the most sensitive ecological areas in the world, particularly an area that has tropical wetlands, and they're raising it with chemical defoliants in order to graze cattle to produce beef. Stop eating those hamburgers, people. Be an environmentalist. Bonus Article 22. Oil companies legally dump toxic waste into the North Sea. So this is just one of those things. It's just the normal practice to dump all this toxic waste into the ocean. Let's stop using the oceans as our toilet. Thank you. Bonus Article 23. A study uncovers dangerous hydrogen sulfide emissions in Central Texas oil fields. So this is some oil wells that are operating and some that have been capped or closed down. And hydrogen sulfide emissions can actually kill you. And people have died by being overwhelmed. But of course, the larger problem is usually people that are nearby, they get higher moderate levels, or people all over the place getting hydrogen sulfide just thrown up into the atmosphere, throw it into the whole mix of pollutions. Not good for us. 24. Air pollution from biomass combustion carries higher cancer potential. This basically means forest fires. So in other words, the air pollution that comes from forest fires, per the way that they measure how much it's air pollution, particulate matter, is actually has a higher cancer potential than the, quote, normal, the previous historical sources of air pollution. 25. How wildfire smoke exposure is is measured doesn't capture long-term health effects and hides racial disparities. So this is part of that a lot of traditional air pollution. It goes up and down, but it stays sort of close to the average. But when you're talking about like wildfire exposure, it gets really high and then goes down, and gets really high and really goes down. And actually, those really large exposures may have more effect than having a small exposure over a longer period of time. Bonus article 26, an industrial chemical showing up in fentanyl in the U.S. troubling scientists. So in the completely unregulated drug market, products are mutating with even more industrial chemicals. Yikes. Bonus article 27, new treatments address addiction alongside trauma. So this is an important thing, is with different risk factors. If you have both an addiction and trauma, can be particularly dangerous, and you need to treat them together. You need a more holistic approach. Bonus article 28, telehealth is a lifeline for opioid use disorder. Congress must renew its use. So this is one of the temporary things that was done during the pandemic, and that's running out, but it's proved to work out really well and should be continued. Bonus article 29, I don't want to die. He needed mental health care. He found a ghost network. So a ghost network is these networks in your health plans that say these providers are there, in this case, mental health care providers. But when you call them up, you find that they either retired, they don't exist, it's a wrong number, they don't accept that insurance anymore, et cetera, et cetera. So this poor guy in this story did die. So I guess he joined the ghost network. Bonus article 30. Decades of national suicide prevention policies haven't slowed the deaths. So this is just kind of there's a lot of things that are causing the rise in suicide deaths in this country. But this is probably the larger story here, is that we really need to get at the larger social determinants to kind of beat down these higher levels of suicide and rising levels that we've seen. Bonus article 31. Last holdout. Arkansas's governor says Medicaid expansion for new moms isn't needed. Arkansas is literally the last state. Every other state has done this Medicaid extension for new moms. Somehow, I guess the laws of healthcare don't apply to Arkansas. Yikes. Still have a long way to go, even in our basic healthcare of at-risk populations. Bonus article 32. Most maternal deaths can be prevented. Here's how California aims to cut them in half. So this is an interesting article, except the thing is, this is kind of a journalistic and a scientific point of view. They're talking about preventing maternal deaths, but really what they're talking about is pregnancy-associated deaths, which is the healthcare aspect of maternal deaths. So if your partner murders you when you have a six-month-old, because maybe that baby wasn't wanted, or maybe there was a pre-existing domestic violence that was aggravated, all kinds of reasons, that actually isn't pregnancy considered pregnancy associated. And those other effects in that first year of life, actually the majority of those are not those healthcare pregnancy associated things. And of course, this California effort actually doesn't provide new resources other than doing some education, which is likely to affect the people who least need it and not reach the people who don't. Bonus article 33, how do abortion pills work? Answers to frequently answered questions. So there's, of course, as far as maternal care, is another women's health issue that is critical. Bonus article 34, historic numbers of Americans live by themselves as they age. Well, this is sort of a women's issue too. Consider women live a lot longer. That's, of course, a good problem to have. But as people age, the proportion of women to men gets much higher. And this article just talks about some of the health issues that older folks living alone may have. Bonus article 35. In historic step, feds make first ever multi-vendor awards to modernize the nation's organ transplant system and end the current contract monopoly. Whew, there's a long title. And that's basically a follow-up to stories I've done before about our messed up organ transplant system. And this is one step to help remediate that. Bonus article 36. A failing healthcare system caused my husband's death with endemic diagnostic error, killing or permanently disabling nearly 800,000 Americans each year. So just another systemic massive deficit in American healthcare with rampant diagnostic error. Bonus article 37. What docs say is driving them away. Four strategies to retain physicians. So it isn't just patients that are fed up with their American healthcare system. It's the providers as well. Bonus Article 38. Reducing smartphone use and or increasing physical activity increases work satisfaction. So stop living a virtual life and get out there and do some physical activity and actually improve your work satisfaction. That probably works for doctors and healthcare providers as well. Bonus Article 39. New consensus report. Myopia should be classified as a disease and kids should spend more time outdoors to help prevent myopia from developing. Myopia, of course, is short-sightedness. And as everyone knows, short-sightedness is also endemic in this country, partly because we never focus on anything larger than the indoor walls. Get outside, people, particularly kids. Bonus Article 40, too many people, particularly men, delay dealing with hearing loss because they think the devices make them look old. Vanity. Bonus Article 41, Poison Control Centers report spike in calls about kids and energy drinks, which are not recommended for kids and teens at all. About half of these are actually unintentional, meaning kids just think they're another soda pop or whatever and drink it and get exposed. Bonus Article 42, last but not least, no concussion. A blow to the head can still be dangerous. So it isn't just the hard hits that matter, it's cumulative. And this is just a good example that for many health problems, it's on a continuum. There's not just some threshold where it becomes a problem. Yes, being hit in the head is not good for you. You can view these and all the other stories I've reported on this show and previous shows by going to toppun.com/blog/WAKT. That's toppun.com/blog/WAKT. Thank you for spending this hour with me, my second most favorite hour of the week. I'll be signing off now from the Jon Snow Memorial Studio. Jon Snow is considered the father of epidemiology, the science of public health. He studied infectious waterborne cholera outbreaks in London and famously persuaded local officials in 1854 to remove a pump handle from the infectious well that he had tracked down as the source. The cholera outbreak ended, and emerging germ theory took a quantum leap forward in battling the then leading causes of death, infectious diseases. May his passion and scientific tenaciousness continue to inspire us all today. Here at WAKT, We Act Radio, passion is an essential ingredient to our life. And while scientific assessment is key to public health success, passion is as much a touchstone to success in living well as anything. So, I will close with a quote from the Reverend Dr. Howard Thurman. Don't ask what the world needs. Ask what makes you come alive and go do it. Because what the world needs is people who have come alive. And on that note, let's take it home with Emma's Revolution. Check them out. I need some-